Good morning, everyone. We are reading in Book 2, Canto 5, and we reach page 166, line 557. Sri Aurobindo has been showing us the life of the ephemeral earthly creature, our daily life on the lower life level. And he says, this is only a stage through which we pass. If that were our permanent state, then yes, our mind would be quite right to think of all this as an illusion, matter that chanced to read itself by mind, in conscience, monstrously engendering soul. We think that we have a soul, we may even feel that we have a soul, but it seems to have no place in this material world. So we can read on from there. Varadarajan, would you start?
At time, all is unreal and remote. We seem to live in a fiction of our thoughts, years from sensations, fanciful traveler's tale. Our part on the film of the recording brain, a figment or circumstance in cosmic sleep. A somnambulist walking under the moon, an image of ego pressed through an ignorant dream. Counting the moment of a spectral time in a false perspective of effect and cause, trusting to a specious trust of world space, we drift incessantly from scene to scene, whither it knows not to what fabulous words. All here is dream or doubt's realness, but who the dreamer is and whence he is still unknown.
Thank you. This is a way of experiencing the world. Some of you may have come across the book. I think it's called The Somnambulists. It's a book about the history of science by Arthur Koestler. And he points out how human beings seem to have been sleepwalking and discovering by accident knowledge about the world. And gradually that gets built up over the ages into a more coherent picture. But who the dreamer is, who is that sleepwalker who is guiding this whole process? And does any of all this really exist? If it's a dream, who is dreaming it? Or there's a different way of looking at it. Would you read the next passage, please? I've forgotten your name.
George,
would you read the next bit? Or the world is real? Yeah.
All the world is real, but ourselves too small, insufficient for that of our stage. A thin life curve crosses the boundary of the orbit of a soulless universe. And in the belly of the sparse rolling mass, a mind looks out from a small causal world and wonders what itself and all things are. And yet, to some internal subjective side that strangely has formed in matter's sightless stuff, a pointing ledge, minute of little self, takes figure as a world being's conscious beings. Such is our scene in the half light below. This is the sign of matter's infinite. This, the veil purport of the picture shown, the science, the giant's measurer of her field. As she pours on the record of her close survey and mathematizes her huge external world, the reason bound within the circle of sense, or in the thoughts brought in impalpable exchange, a speculator in tenuous, fast ideas, abstractions in the void
Thank you. So perhaps after all, the world is real, but we ourselves are so tiny in comparison with this vast material universe. We are not developed enough to really play a part on this mighty stage. If we look at the world as we know it, the cosmos as we know it, there's just this thin curve of life on the surface of our material earth. And it's orbiting around and around its own axis around the sun, and the whole galaxy is moving. And yet this whole universe seems to be soulless, purely material. But somewhere in the very middle, in the belly of this sparse, rolling mass, scattered with suns and stars and asteroids, somewhere a mind, our mind, looks out from this little casual globe that could have formed by chance, and we are wondering about ourselves and about everything else. And yet, says Sri Aurobindo, to some inner sight, in turn subjective sight, some self-awareness that has formed within us, strangely has formed in the unconscious stuff of matter, there's a tiny little point of self-awareness. Pointillage, a little tiny, there are many of these tiny little spots. This almost seems, at least to this subjective sight, that this is the conscious basis for this whole world existence. Are we the only conscious beings in all this? We tiny little creatures? This seems to be the sign of the infinity of matter. This is the strange picture that appears to science, this gigantic figure of our times, science, measuring her field of perception. And then she looks carefully at all the measurements she has made, puts all this into mathematical relationships. She's using reason, the power of deduction and induction, based on the sense impressions. It's bound within the circle of perception given to her by the senses, or the tools that she's made to increase the range of her sense perceptions. And there's some speculation also in our thought. We speculate it might be like this or it might be like that. Vast theories, yeah, but we don't know what they are based on. These are just abstractions in the emptiness, and we don't know what value they have. Probably they don't have any firm value on which they are based, the theories of science. But there's something which claims to be reliable. Would you read it, Crystal, please?
Only religion in this bankruptcy presents its dubious riches to our hearts. Our science unprovisioned checks and beyond. Our poverty shall there have its revenge. Our spirits depart, discarding a futile life into the blank unknown, or we then take death's passport into immortality.
As we can rely on science or we can rely on religion, neither of them seem to be very reliable. Religion promises us if we do certain things in this world, we'll reap the rewards in the beyond. Our poverty shall there have its revenge. So our spirits will leave this world, dropping off this futile little life. Where are we going? Into the blank unknown. And perhaps we have this passport with us that promises us entry into the immortal state. Patricia.
Yesterday, Yet was this only a provisional scheme, false appearance, set by limiting sense, mind's insufficient self-discipline, an early attempt, a first experiment. This was a toy to amuse the infant earth. The knowledge ends not in these surface powers that live upon a ledge in the universe and dare not look into the dangerous depth or to stare upward, measuring the unknown. There is a deeper seeing from within, and when we have left these small purlieus of mind, a greater vision meets us on the heights, in the luminous wideness of the Spirit's gaze. At last there wakes in us a witness soul that looks at truths unseen and scans the unknown, then all assumes a new and marvelous face. The world quivers with a godlight at its core, in time's deep heart, high purposes move and live. Life's borders crumble and join infinity. This broad, confused, yet rigid scheme becomes a magnificent imbroglium of the gods. Again, a work ambiguously divine.
Thank you. Anybody can tell us what an imbroglio is? Lella? Yeah, a very complicated story, a plot with many ins and outs, a tangle.
A trap, you can translate it into a trap story, falling into a trap and in horror.
It catches hold of you and you're stuck and you can't find your way out of the maze.
Yeah. You say something to people and they fall into it and they are faint.
This reference to the provisional scheme, this, is it religion?
No, it's this little life, the way things are. A purlieu, the purlieus. At the moment, we are within the purlieus of Savitripavan, the territory, the area. And we are also within the small purlieus of mind, within the borderlines or the walls. When we can move out, then a greater vision meets us on the heights.
How to connect us with greater vision?
Yes. So I think that's what Sri Aurobindo wants to show us in this poem, is the way out. And that in this universe that we are living in, there are many levels, and we are inevitably moving from one to the next, but we can also consciously decide to do that and participate in this evolving process. So the next lines are quite illuminating about that. Would you?
Our seekings are short-lived experiments made by a wordless and inscrutable power, testing its distance from inconscient mind to meet its luminous self of truth and living. It peers at the real truth in apparent form. It labors in our mortal mind and sense. Amid the figures of the ignorance and the simple pictures drawn by word and thought, it seeks the truth to which all things point. It looks for the source of light with vision's lens. It works behind the doer of all works, the unfelt self within whom is the God, the unknown self above whom is the good.
Yes, thank you. This is the true meaning of our life. We can't help seeking for knowledge, for more, for bliss. And these seekings are just short-lived experiments that are being made, he says, by a wordless and inscrutable power, a mysterious, silent power, which is trying out the way in which it can escape the ways out, the issues from inconscient night, the unconsciousness of matter and material mind. Something within us is trying to find its way out. It wants to discover, or it will eventually discover, its luminous self of truth and bliss. It's the true conscious being within us. But at first, it's trapped in this inconscient night and has very limited means of testing its ways out. It tries this, it tries that. So it's trying to find out what is real, but all it has to go on are the apparent forms shown to us by our senses. That power is laboring, trying hard to find out reality through our mortal mind and sense. Here we are amidst all the figures, the images shown to us by the ignorance, these symbol pictures presented to us by word and thought. But that power is actually searching for the truth to which all these figures are pointing. No? It's looking for the source of light. What is the source of consciousness? But what have we got to look with? We only have this power of material vision. What we're looking for is the source of the consciousness that allows us to see. We are involved in activity. We can't help being involved in activity. And through our activities, perhaps we can find eventually the power that is doing everything. Perhaps we can find the unfelt self within us who is guiding all this process. And then we will be able to contact that unknown self above the truth to which all figures point. So is that possible? Are we going to be able to do that? Let's see what he says next.
All is not here blinded, nature's task. The word of wisdom watches us from on high, a witness sanctioning her will and works. An eye unseen in the unseeing lost. There is an influence from the light above. There are thoughts remote and sealed eternities. A mystic drives the stars and suns in this passage from a deaf, unknown force. To struggling consciousness and transient breath, a mighty supernature waits on time. The world is our, and we nothing can see. Our lives are deeper mystery than we have dreamed. Our minds are starters in the race to God. Our souls, deputed selves of whom supreme, across the cosmic fields, through narrow lanes, asking a scanty dough from fortune's hands, and garbed in beggar's robes, there walks the one.
Thank you. All is not here a blinded nature's task. It's not just unconscious evolution of material nature. There's a higher power watching, a word, a wisdom. There's a witness watching and saying yes or no to what nature wills and does. We don't see that eye, or perhaps occasionally we may get a glimpse of it, but it's there watching us in this apparently unseeing vastness of material space. There's an influence from a light above. There are distant thoughts, sealed eternities, sealed to us for now, but there's a mystic motive driving these material stars and suns that make up our universe. We are going through a passage. He called it earlier on a stage, not a stage, a passage. In this passage from a deaf, unknowing force, the unconscious nature, to perhaps the stage we are in at the moment, struggling consciousness, transient breath, short-lived lives. Something else is waiting. A mighty supernature is waiting for the time to be ripe. This world is other than we now think and see. It's not a purely material scene. Our lives are a much deeper mystery than we have imagined. And our minds, our ignorant minds, they are starters in the race to God. We can all participate in this race. Our souls are deputed selves of the Supreme. We have been sent from the Supreme to participate in this race, in this struggle, in this evolving process. And we don't know it, but here in the cosmic field, there's this beautiful picture wandering through the narrow lanes like a beggar, just asking a scanty dole, a small gift from fortune's hands. Will she give or will she not give? Garbed in beggar's robe, there walked the one. And we are those beggars passing through the narrow lane, waiting to see what fortune will give us. But it's the one within that wordless and inscrutable power who is guiding the search. Fanny, you've lost the place. Line 654. Even in the theater of these small lives. You're not too well today. You'll read, Monica.
Even in the theater of these small lives, we have a secret sweetness of breath.
Breathe.
And you. So my touch is not perfect. And you're from miniature divinity, a mystic passion from the wells of God flows through the guarded spaces of the soul, a force that helps support the suffering earth, an unseen nearness and the hidden joy. There are muffled throbs of laughters, undertones, the murmur of an occult happiness, an exaltation in depths of sleep, a heart of bliss living a world of pain, an infant nursed on nature's covered breast, an infant playing in the magic woods, floating to rapture by the spirit's dreams, awaits the hour when we shall turn to his home.
Thank you. So even in this little life, this theater of these small lives we are living, behind the act, there's a secret sweetness, breathing, keeping it all alive and growing. An urge of miniature divinity. There's this mystic passion, this intensity, thank you, from the wells of God, is flowing through these secret spaces of our souls. And a force that helps is supporting this suffering earth. An unseen nearness. A hidden joy is keeping us all going. We hardly hear them, but there are muffled throbs of laughter's undertone. You know, muffled, we don't, stifled, not properly heard. The murmur of an occult happiness. And in the depths of our sleep of unconsciousness, there is an exaltation, an intense delight. There's a heart of bliss within this world of pain. And this is because of the presence of this child, this infant. When we read of this infant with a capital I, we think of Lord Krishna. That child is being nursed by nature, and he plays in the magic woods. We might hear his flute in the distance, but we can't catch him. But still, he's calling out, attracting us, fluting to rapture by the spirit's streams. He is waiting for the hour when we shall wake up and turn to his call. Sorry? Yes, if we think of Lord Krishna in the forest, and then there are the lovely little rivers beside, it could be, beside the stream.
This muffled drops of laughter's undertone, I think that sometimes there when the divine is laughing when we are and the contradiction is so difficult.
Yes, for sure.
And then the divine looks on him.
Yes, and he's just laughing at us. Yeah. And he plays mischief on us also. He plays tricks, no? Lord Krishna. Then he laughs at us. Francis.
In this Krishna, is
some that is a spark of God's life. In something breaks through the soul and spirit and cleanness fight that makes us as live. In our body cells, there sit iron core that sees and see and plans eternity. Our smaller parts are weak or deeper. We shall shape.
You've skipped a page.
In that too, the world and the center and love. The door is cut in the mud, wall of sight. Across the lonely threshold with both hands. Enter the study and self-healing path. Lodge in the meanness and curve of will. The maker of the image of the intake life. And pity is God and following it, sacrifice in flesh's sympathy and tenderness, cut hardened light from the heart's secluded shrine.
Yes, this is so beautiful, no? Here we are. We are in this earthly life, this material life, fleshly life. It's like a robe that's been put on us, an investiture that we have to wear. But within it, there's a soul that is a spark of God. And sometimes that soul breaks through the sordid screen of the fleshly life and kindles a fire that makes us half divine, even in the cells of our body, of the fleshly body, there sits a hidden power. That wordless and inscrutable power is within every one of ourselves, cells and particles. And that hidden power sees what we don't see, and it's planning. Long-term planning for eternity. And because of that presence, even our smallest parts have room for deepest needs. Into these smallest parts of the being, the golden messengers can come. It's as if in this fleshly body, this mud wall of our little self, it's a mud wall, so it can be cut. A door gets cut, and these golden messengers, these angels of ecstasy, they have to bow their heads to pass through that little mud door. No? But they do pass through, these angels of ecstasy and self-giving. These are the powers of the soul, and they live there in this innermost sanctuary of dream. There they are at work. They're preparing our divine selves. Pity is there, sacrifice, flashes of sympathy and tenderness cast heaven lights from the heart's secluded shrine, from the home of the soul. Turiya.
Work is done in the deep silences. A glory and wonder of spiritual sense, a laughter is given in place, and all in world experiencing the joy, inhabit the mystery of the untouched curves, blurred by time's beats, eternity sleeps in us. In the sealed hermetic heart, the happy core can move behind this outer shape. The eternal entity prepares within its matter of divine felicity, its way of heavenly phenomena.
Thank you. So this is our hope, no? That the eternal entity is preparing in each one of us its matter of divine felicity, its reign of heavenly phenomenon.
Inhabit the mystery of the untouched curves.
Yes. There's this work is going on, although we don't hear it, these deep inner silences. And there's a glory and wonder of spiritual sense, and a laughter in beauty's everlasting space. These things are inhabiting the mystery of the untouched gulfs, these deep unconscious parts, and they transform. They can transform world experience into joy, lulled by time's beats. Eternity sleeps in us. This potential of eternity is as if like a child sleeping within us. And the eternal entity is at work, no? In this tightly sealed heart. But the happy core, the very center where the psychic being is, unmoved behind this outer shape of death, this physical being, the eternal entity is preparing within us its matter of divine felicity, a different kind of matter, no? And its reign of heavenly phenomenon. So things happen even in our ordinary experience. That comes next. Mihong, will you read?
In our scanning mind of the ignorance, a foresight comes of some immense release. Our will lifts towards it slow and shaping hands, which part in us desires its absolute. Our thoughts covet the everlasting light. Our strength derives from an omnipotent force, and since from a very God joy, the world is well made, and since eternal beauty asks for form. Even here, where all is made of beings, thus our hearts are captured by ensnaring shapes. Our very senses blindly seek for bliss. Our error crucifies reality to force its birth and divine body here, compelling, incarnate in a human form, and breathing in limbs that one can touch and trust. Its knowledge to rescue an ancient ignorance. Its savior light, the inconstant river. And when the greater self comes, see light down to feel this image of our transience. All shall be captured by delight, transformed in waves of undreamed ecstasy, shall roll our mind and life and sense and love in a light. Other than this, I'm limited in my
You want to let Jean-Yves go on? You continue.
Our mind and life and sense and life in the light other than this hardened, limited human day, the body's tissues free, apotheosized, its cells sustained by metamorphosis. This little being of time, this shadow soul, this living dwarf figure head of darkened spirit out of its traffic. It dreams to arrive, his shape of person and his evil face, divested of his mortal travesty, like a clay drawn immediately into a god, new made in the image of the eternal guest, he shall be caught to the breast of a wide fall, and flaming with a paradisal touch, in a rose fire of sweet spiritual grace. In the red passion of his infinite shame, quiver, awake, and shudder with ecstasy.
Thank you. Because of that presence within us, even now in our state of skeptic mind of ignorance, there is an aspiration towards the change. Our will is lifting towards it. Slow hands, but they are shaping that future possibility. Each part in us is desiring its absolute, its fulfillment, our thoughts, our strength, our love of beauty and bliss. And our error, our mistakes and stumblings, they are in a way torturing the reality, but that is to force its birth and divine body here. It's part of the process of bringing about that great transformation, compelling, incarnate in a human form, and breathing in limbs that one can touch and clasp. Its knowledge, the knowledge of that reality, must rescue our ancient ignorance and save the inconscient universe by its savior light. And here again is one of these great prophecies and promises that Sri Aurobindo gives us. When that greater self, our own greater self, comes pouring down on us like an ocean to fill this little human image of our transience. Everything shall be captured by delight, transformed. Our mind and life and sense will be rolled in waves of undreamed ecstasy, shall know another light other than this hard, limited human day. And the body's tissues will be apotheosized, divinized. Its cells will bear this metamorphosis, this complete change of form. This little being of time, this shadow soul, this living dwarf figurehead of darkened spirit, out of its traffic in petty dreams shall rise. And it'll be changed. Its whole shape of person, its ego face, will be taken away. This mortal travesty, this caricature of its true self. It'll be like a little mud doll, a clay troll, which gets kneaded by divine hands into the form of a god, new made in the image of the eternal guest. It shall be caught to the breast of a white force and flaming with that paradisal touch in a rose fire of sweet spiritual grace, in the red passion of its infinite change, quiver, awake, shudder with ecstasy.
Okay. As if traversing the deformation of spell, release from the black magic, the mind, renouncing the servitude to the den of others, shall learn at last to live and unseen, and seized with moral the adoring heart, then from which child, godhead, and the angels operate, trembling with beauty and delight. But first, the spirits ascend to the last issue of the chasm from which our nature rose. The soul must soar, sovereign above the form, and climb to summits beyond mind's heights. Our hearts must be born with the need of strength, surprise the animal with a cold thought, then kindling the gold. Time of sacrifice, calling the powers of life, we shall shed this courage of our mortal state, make the baptism the road of heaven's descent, operate our depths with the supernatural grace, to cleave the darkness with the mystic fire.
Thank you. Yes.
Line 7:14.
Yes. Yes. Well, there's this whole evolutionary process going on. He's been telling us about the level of the little life. And even in that level, the spirit is struggling to find ways out and ways up. And he's giving us the great promise, the wonderful promise of where that's going to lead to. But still, we have to achieve that ascent. Out of the little life first, out of the chasm, that deep hole from which our human nature has evolved. This soul within us must grow stronger. It must be able to fly high like a great bird above the form of the body. And it has to be able to climb above the level of mind, this half sleep of mind. And our hearts, instead of being driven by all these impulses of the little life, they have to become filled with heavenly strength. And this animal being of our outer self has to be surprised by the God hidden within it, the divine being. And when that happens, then our lives can become a constant sacrifice an act of sacrifice. Every action that we do, this is what the message of Sri Krishna in the Gita, no? Kindling that golden tongue of sacrifice, of self-giving, and calling with our aspiration, we're calling down powers of a bright hemisphere, how far above this dark hemisphere we live in now, we shall be able to let fall like a used cloak. We'll shed the discredit of our mortal state, our present mortal state, subject to the grip of ignorance and death. Then this deep hole that we have risen up out of, that abysm, we shall turn it into a road down which all the heavenly powers can descend into matter, so that the very depths of our being will become familiar with that wonderful ray from above, and the darkness will be cleaved, cut apart, driven apart by the light of that mystic fire, the fire of divine will and strength. So that's a wonderful close to this canto on the Godheads of the little life. He's shown us the powers that are influencing us in our lower life parts. Yes.
They're in line 738.
Yes.
The child Godhead.
Yes. I think this is my personal interpretation. The mother has painted this child Godhead also in some of the paintings, Meditations on Savitri. There's the divine, as the divine child, which is growing in all the forms of the universe.
All the forms, I don't understand. All of the forms growing?
It's growing in all the forms of the universe. So it's like an expression of the evolution. It starts small and weak, but it grows stronger and stronger. And of course, that child within us is also the soul. Mm-hmm. And that infant who's playing in the woods and waking us up to his bliss and youthfulness, eternal youthfulness.
But Sharanana, your question, long time I tell my dream when I meet Krishna, my dream is not really the dream, it's a vision. And give me milk.
He's feeding you.
Drink,
nourishing you. Wow.
30 years, 88. Mm. And now, after 38, it's incredible. Mm. You tell me, maybe 10 years ago in Savitri class, sometimes something coming, but now coming knowledge, some knowledge. Mm. Unexpected.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Why does he use the word golden tongue of sacrifice?
Yes, well, it's the sacrificial flame. And if it's golden, then it means it's very pure. No? And it's a flame like a tongue. No? That's what carries our sacrifice to the Lord. So King Aswapati has explored that whole realm of the little life, the outer aspect and the inner aspect. And now he's moving on. You'll read Rita, please.
Eventually, once more in the natal mist, across the dangerous haze, the pregnant stirred, he, through the astral chaos, showed a way mid the grey faces of its demon gods, questioned by whispers of its flickering ghosts, besieged by sorceries of its fluent force. As one who walks unguided through strange fields, tending he knows not where nor with what hope, he trod a soil that failed beneath his feet and journeyed in stone strength to a fugitive end. His trail behind him was a vanishing line of glimmering points in a vague immensity. A bodiless murmur traveled at his side in the wounded gloom, complaining against light. A huge obstruction, its immobile heart, the watching opacity multiplied as he moved. Its hostile mass of dead and staring eyes. The darkness glimmered like a dying torch around him, an extinguished phantom glow, peopled with shadowy and misleading shapes, the vague inconscience, dark and measureless cave. His only sunlight was his spirit's flame.
We are starting from the image of the world stair, of these levels of existence, these planes of existence, each with their worlds and their powers and inner and outer aspect. And that's how we have seen him, sort of mounting up a stairway or a mountainside. But here Sri Aurobindo is showing us that at least on these life levels, the organized worlds are surrounded by a kind of chaos of darkness and mist, which is quite hostile. This is the dark cave of the inconscient, and that it sounds really rather terrible to have to travel through that natal mist from one level to the next level. There's the haze, it's dangerous. There's something moving. It'll give birth at any moment. We don't know through what. This is the astral chaos. The occultists talk about this astral plane, which surrounds and gives access to all the other planes.
The mental world or the vital world?
I think we are still on the vital level. You know? He's passing from one life level, the level of the little life, to the greater life. But there's this dangerous passage in between. It's inhabited by demon gods, ghosts, sorceries. And he's not really sure where he's going. As one who walks unguided through strange fields, tending he knows not where. He doesn't know exactly where he's going, and he doesn't know exactly what he's aiming at. And that ground that he's treading on seems to be very unreliable, as it was at the beginning of Canto 3, when he first entered those life worlds. It was very unreliable, unsure, unfirm earth, quaking and swampy. He has to gather all his strength. He journeyed in stone strength, and whatever it is that he's aiming at keeps receding. It's fugitive, it's running away from him. And he can see the light that has been left by his steps behind him is just getting swallowed up, glimmering point, getting swallowed up by that immense haze. And there are voices, a bodiless murmur traveled at his side, complaining in the wounded gloom. The gloom, the darkness feels harmed, hurt by his light. And those voices are complaining about it. The very heart of that darkness is a huge obstruction. And as he moves, he feels that he's being watched. He can't see what is watching him, but there's only this hostile mass of dead and staring eyes. And there's a kind of faint light in the darkness around him, like a torch about to go out. He feels around him in that perishing glow. It's peopled. There are many shadowy, misleading shapes. He's in the vague, inconscience, dark and measureless cave. And the only sunlight that he's carrying with him is the flame of his own spirit. That is what can guide him further. So I think we'll stop there for today. Next week we'll move into the greater life. Thanks to Shubhi.